Pushkin.
Your mom left the South Side of Chicago. She lives with you now in New Jersey.
Yeah, but more specifically, like, she didn't just leave. She purchased a handgun a couple of years ago because she wasn't feeling safe.
Yeah, yeah. And that's someone who should not be, she's got a shaky hand, I know. She should not be wielding a gun.
Yeah. So when she told me this, I was like, Mom, you have to move here. Like, if it's come to that, like, Chicago needs another handgun on the street, right? Mm-hmm. So if it comes to that, then it's time for you to come be with us. I'm Khalil Gibran Muhammad.
And I'm Ben Austin. We're two best friends.
One black.
One white.
I'm a historian.
And I'm a journalist.
And this is Some of My Best Friends Are.
In this show, we wrestle with the challenges
and the absurdities
of a deeply divided and unequal country.
In today's episode, we talk about violence and it's personal. We're talking about our hometown. We're talking about our neighborhood. We're talking about the most spectacular instances of gun violence. We're worried. We're worried about overcorrecting or going back to business as usual, that somehow policing is going to solve this all on its own. And ultimately, we have solutions that will actually fix these problems and has very little to do actually with law enforcement. So, hey, man, we haven't really talked about this, but Hyde Park, our home neighborhood, has experienced unprecedented violence collapsing in one day. How are you doing? What's going on now? What's the response?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, there was a day where there was a shooting with automatic gunfire in Harper Court. There was a murder of a University of Chicago student. And a murder, a stabbing of a man in a domestic situation. I don't even know much more about it. And it's really scary. I mean, people are scared. There's, you know, the loss of life. And then thinking about, you know, for me, and I think for you too, like, how do you feel safe?
But also, you guys, yeah.
But also the fear that there's going to be some response that is going to be like, more policing, and it's going to cause other problems. Like, I'm scared of that.
Right. Yeah. Well, I can tell you from my mom, who I've gotten a lot of reports on. She's watching.
Yeah, I see her on social media every day, talking about it. So
yeah, I mean, she and I have basically been having an ongoing conversation about it because she's getting news stories. She's talking to people who live in Chicago, live in your neighborhood, and I'm really concerned not only about, you know, how people experience what's happened, but also what comes next.
Yeah. You know, people in a moment like this decide to pack up and leave. Like, it's an existential moment. You know, people are like, I've had enough.
Yeah.
And this is what destroys communities.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I tell you that I have neighbors who are like, is this the breaking point? Should we leave? And I hate hearing that. I hate it. I mean, and I know that people, you know, that we have to have really honest discussions about crime and safety, but you know, I feel committed to this city and to this neighborhood. And so there's something so destructive for me.
It's also, I think, what I'm most interested in talking to you about today is exactly how this moment opens up possibilities that we haven't really done before. And or in thinking about the summer of George Floyd and everything that came and the, you know, the possibilities of really understanding the relationship of social justice and policing, you know.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, this is the moment. This is the moment to test our mettle, right?
Yeah.
To see,
yeah,
because what we're willing to do.
The responses to crime, and in a moment like this, they're almost predictable, more policing. But we want to talk about, you know, what are other responses? What are other responses that are better? So let's go to Hyde Park. Let's look exactly at what happened there, and let's look at the responses. Yeah, so I called up Sophia King, who is my local alderman. So, Sophia, I'm recording.
Oh, are you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. She's good. She's good people. And I just saw her when I was there a couple weeks ago when I visited town. I saw her.
And I wanted to hear what happened from her perspective.
There were at least, I think, 27 shell casings found, which, you know, again, just underscores the brazenness of it.
And so we're pulling onto Harper right now, coming from Kenwood. And this is our route, essentially, every day for lunch, you know, Kenwood Kids.
Right. I mean, and so at noon, you know, it's a busy street. And it's right in the middle of the day in downtown Hyde Park. It could have been a mass murder.
And also get a better sense of what the responses have been, because she's been in hundreds of meetings since then with concerned, you know, what everyone, the stakeholders, as we call them, right?
People are calling for more policing. My response is that this is also an opportunity to have alternative policing.
Like the neighbors, the store owners, the University of Chicago.
As you probably have heard, the Kilwins owner, you know, it was a traumatic experience for her and her employees who, you know, luckily weren't in the windows that were shot out. But, you know, in that regard, it was traumatic and people were hurt. Her business is still closed.
They're scared and they want to know what to do about this crime. And they want to know what she's going to do because, you know, a crime occurs and then what is the proper response? I mean, that's where you and I are always talking about this.
Right.
You know, I just want to make sure that there's the appropriate response. And speaking of, you know, appropriate policing, there are other avenues.
And she's a neighbor, too. And I know that she's experiencing this in a real way that, you know, I'm friends with her and I've known her for years. But I know that she's also on the block driving around, has some of the same concerns that Danielle, my wife, has and also that I have.
Do you feel less safe? Are you taking more precautions?
No, I do. I do feel less safe. I come out of my parking. I'm out of my garage and I'm turning my head and going.
You've had friends on your block.
Yes, I've had friends. I've had my good friends who were carjacked, and it's very traumatic for them. It's traumatic for me to know that happened, to know how they feel, and it's hard to internalize it.
You and I are constantly talking about over-policing and also about responses to crime and about the criminal justice system. And so here we are in our neighborhood where I live and where you grew up and where your mom just left. And there's this crime that occurs. And how do you respond to it in the short term, in the long term? What do you do to make people feel more safe and then, you know, not make things worse at the same time?
Yeah.
I mean, so here we are, right? Where we are, what are we? A year and a half. We're a year and a half.
What are we? I thought you were going to say we are two leading experts on criminal justice system.
We're a year and a half since the massive protests following the murders of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor by police officers and widespread calls for defund the police. And you know, then when crime occurs, when it occurs in Chicago, when it occurs all over the country, people return to this sense of like, well, shit, we must need more policing. You know, forget defund. We need actually more policing because that's what's going to keep us safe. That there is still this fallback to the kind of status quo sensibility of public safety.
Yeah. I mean, I would put it a little differently. I would say that while it's certainly true, we've seen news reports of refund, almost every city that promised some kind of cut has put a lot of that money back in cities all over the country. I would say that part of what I'm sensing from the conversations that are happening on social media about what's happening in Chicago and even sort of watching the New York City mayoral race here is that there's this sense that the uptick in violence requires an immediate response, like somehow the protests unleashed a sense of entitlement to the streets, that lawlessness has just sort of taken advantage. My mom even used the word like, these are people who are doing things out of opportunity. And that somehow, like a tourniquet, there needs to be some immediate response to stop the bleeding. And then we could get back to these bigger questions. And I think that's the kind of the tension, certainly the tension I feel in my own household talking about this, but it's also the tension I think I feel when I'm listening to people, you know, who have a more complicated response to this than just the old law and order stuff from back in the day. And I'm wondering, what does Sophia say about this? How does she balance this tension and awareness of like the consequences of kind of going back to a much more vigorous police presence?
Yeah, I mean, Sophia is complicated. She's the head of the Progressive Caucus in the city council. She does ask for things like alternative forms of policing. She asks for funding for, you know, housing and schools. But she also wants boots on the ground. She wants more police officers. Yeah. Sophia, in a way, is going to be held accountable for this.
Right. She's directly responsible.
If people feel unsafe, someone's going to run against her and say, I'm the safety candidate.
Right.
And so she has to respond to this.
I think we should move towards those ideals, but keep some real boots on the ground. That's the reality. So like I said, I think we need more presence, and police is part of that. I also think, you know, positive loitering and having a bustling and hustling business is a part of it. But you're right. You know, these are crimes of opportunity where there's not much, you know, somebody could do.
I mean, one of the reasons I think we decided to have a bigger conversation about it happening here in Hyde Park is that, like, I'm experiencing that need for an immediate response. Mm-hmm. This is the community where we live, you know? So this is real for my family. So Lysia, my daughter, who is 16, still walks to and from school. And now that it's winter, it's dark when she comes back. And every day after school, she likes to stop by the Medici, this restaurant and get, you know, like a baguette.
Our favorite pizza place back in the day.
But her friends have been told that they're not allowed to go out with her. Not because she's a bad influence.
Really?
Or maybe that is the reason, I don't know.
No.
But because the parents are worried about crime and they can't be out when it's after school or walk around.
Okay. So this is a totally new thing in response to the shootings that happened in Hyde Park most recently. This is right now.
Yeah, happening. I mean, she has one friend who, this is, you know, I heard this secondhand from a 16-year-old. So take it like that. But who she was told that she can't sit in the front of their home that's facing the street because they're worried about stray gunfire.
Wow. I mean, that's real, right? In every possible way, and people do get killed randomly, and oftentimes kids. But like this is our neighborhood. Yeah. Like it's a very middle class, upper income community, and so the thought that that's the advice now in Hyde Park is really wild.
And you know, I have talks with her about not being the low hanging fruit, about not walking with her phone out and looking at her phone. That there have been a lot of robberies of people just pulling up and jumping people and taking their phones. And often with guns, you know, saying, give me what you have. And so I tell her not to be that person who is with her head down in a phone and looks like an easy target.
Yeah.
I went to a meeting of the Chamber of Commerce. I did this on Zoom. And all the store owners from the neighborhood were like, they wanted to know what to do. And it wasn't like they were all demanding more police, but they were like, what do we do to feel safe? You know, should we have cameras? Right. Should we have drones? Should we, like, you know, should there be security guards? Like, they wanted something.
Yeah. And I mean, just to add to that, I also read an open letter written by something like 300 faculty members at the University of Chicago in response to the killing of a Chinese national student.
So the student who was robbed.
The student was robbed
a Chinese national student who was here in the neighborhood, and he's the third University of Chicago student killed this year, and the second one who is an international student.
Yeah, yeah. And in that letter, and a couple things jumped out. I mean, to this point about how do you respond? I mean, there was like literally a call for surveillance cameras, and this is not an exaggeration, on every intersection in Hyde Park, and while they didn't quite say cops on every corner, they did say security guards on every corner.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I can certainly understand it because the stakes of what that very significant response might mean in terms of delivering public safety cut against the other problems which gave rise to police reform debates, which is what happens when you over-police a community and everyone's treated like a suspect, especially if they happen to be Black and brown. Like, this is where I think my mom and those faculty members at the UFC are probably not that far apart, right?
Yeah.
Because there is this sense like you have to do something in the moment. You have to do something now to lock it down.
That's exactly right.
I'm really interested, maybe not so much in alternative policing, but I want to talk about alternatives to policing.
That's it. Say it.
So let's talk about safety and justice and what that looks like without policing.
Yes, safety and justice without policing. Well put.
That's right, because people want those things, but they're having a hard time trying to get there without police playing a big role.
Yo, so Khalil, in the aftermath of the shooting in Hyde Park, the murder in Hyde Park, I guess, you know, the robbery and killing and another stabbing murder in Hyde Park all in one day and the general uptick in crime that's been going on.
Everywhere, right? Yeah.
One of the things that's been real clear to me is just like people need some kind of response to it. And they need a sense of safety, and that could come in all sorts of forms. There's that demand for a sense of accountability or righting the moral balance. And here in Hyde Park after those crimes, what was offered was more policing.
Yeah, a lot more cops, right? I mean, my mom the other night over dinner, she looked at me and she was like, you know, this is terrible. You know, she mentioned Donald Trump's call for the National Guard a few years ago and said something to the effect of like, you know, maybe Donald Trump was right about that, right for the wrong reasons, because he really didn't care about Chicago. But maybe since the police are failing, the National Guard can do better.
Yeah.
And she said it in a way that she's like, and I know you don't agree. But she was also daring me to have a better response.
Yeah. I think I might have told you this. I'm not sure. But, you know, my brother, Jake, who runs a music venue in the neighborhood, just a block from where that shooting happened.
Yeah, yeah. The Promontory.
The Promontory. Yeah. The Friday after the shooting, he was having a show there, a concert that happened to be a rap act, you know. And the police essentially showed up and were like, nah, nah, if you have this show and anything happens anywhere in the neighborhood at any time afterward, we're going to hold you accountable. And so he had to postpone the show.
Is that even lawful? I mean, for real, though. I mean, this in asking that question is just a little tip of the spear of where the slippery slope ends up. So, I mean, just to kind of put a pin on this point. So, you know, this is in many ways hotspot policing as the entire neighborhood of Hyde Park. This is basically the idea that you have a hotspot, right? An area where we've identified a lot of crime happening in a concentrated space. And in the tradition of hotspot policing that's been going on for about 25 years, now this community, our community, which hasn't really experienced this level of intensified, spectacular violence, now is saying, we want all these things that we've tried in what's called high crime areas that are often low income communities, often with Black and brown
people. So that's what's been presented here. Let's you and I talk about some other alternatives to policing, not alternative policing, but alternatives to policing.
Right. We know, to your point, like we know that the menu of options is actually much greater than what we're even hearing in our own home community.
All right. So let's run through it. Let's run through the menu.
Right. That's right. Let's call these the shovel ready immediate responses.
Okay. Ding, ding, ding. We got shovel ready immediate responses.
No, because when you think about opportunity out of crisis, you think about like what's on the shelf that we can mobilize at this moment. And maybe we hardwire it as a long-term fix.
So I'm going to throw out one first.
Okay, go for it.
Violence interruption.
Yes, yes. I think in fact, if we were playing a version of a Family Feud, that would be the number one answer. Why is that the case? Because the very concept of putting people who already live in a community in charge of conflict mediation, who have trustworthy relationships with members of the community, who can go to them and say, hey, I've got a problem with so-and-so, and if someone doesn't help me fix it, you know, there's going to be drama, there's going to be violence, and we need to figure out a way to stop this before it happens. And this is a 20-year-old proven approach to violence mediation, and it's working in Chicago, it's working in Baltimore, it's working in New York City. I've seen it up close with my own eyes. And it's been discussed in some ways nationally
but not enough.
Yeah, I mean, so we have to invest hugely in community violence interruption. It's proven, it's empirically strong, and it works.
Okay, so second on the menu. So the fact is that about probably more than 90% of what police respond to are nonviolent offenses. And so
that's right. And sometimes the numbers are as low as 5%. Yeah. I mean, in terms of what they actually record calls for service, right? That's the data we have for when police actually are responding to someone, member of the public saying, I need help. About 5% or less of those often are for something that we call violence.
So there's another solution, which is that for first responders to mental health crises, to homelessness cases, to many drug cases, to even traffic stops, you could send people who are experts in those and who are not armed police officers. You can have That's a different right. set of first responders.
That's right. This is just about people who need help. And in a society, particularly in communities that are starved for resources, there just isn't a whole lot of infrastructure if you need help. If you got somebody in distress, if you need, I mean, I know in our own suburban community, police officers literally, I mean, like the old classic case of my cat crawled up into a tree. Could you help get my cat out of the tree? I know this for a fact because I've been at meetings where people have talked about how ridiculous it is that the police have to do this kind of thing.
But, you know, when people talk about defund, if there's a limited pool of money, that more of that money would go to these alternatives, these other responders, rather than to armed police officers to take on these cases, which they have not been trained in many cases to do, almost in all cases.
They're not
mental health experts. They're not social service workers, those kinds of things.
That's right. And so
this is something that's also been done in cities and states across the country.
Yes.
A third thing on the menu is something that actually some of my neighbors brought up here in response to the recent spate of crime, and that's having more positive loitering. So, you know, one of my neighbors talked about having ambassadors going out on the street, and definitely not a community watch, and definitely not something to call the police on people, but just to be present on corners and to meet people and to build community. This is something that also happens in Englewood, the neighborhood where we discussed in the episode with Tanika Johnson.
Fighting inequities throughout, yes.
Yeah, and you know, there are a group of mothers that hang out on corners on Fridays and Saturday nights to make sure that violence doesn't happen. This is a way to build community and to strengthen the bonds in different neighborhoods.
Yeah. So I mean, the sociologists call this collective efficacy, and some of my own colleagues have written a lot about this. Basically, communities that have thriving nonprofit organizations that are doing art activities, that are doing youth-based activities, where there's just a lot of rich social engagement, and that it often is taking place in public spaces, often is not just a deterrent to crimes of opportunity, but also is a sign of community well-being and this kind of a virtuous cycle.
So, you know, we presented these ideas, but none of them are really going to get us to, like, you know, deeper structural changes. They're not going to get us there in terms of public safety.
Right.
You know, people have been out of work. They've been out of school. They've seen the unequal responses to the pandemic. And this is on, you know, the tail end of police violence and foreclosure crisis and closed schools and closed hospitals and closed mental health facilities. And, you know, this idea that you treat the effect of all those causes, which is violence, the uptick in violence that we're seeing in Chicago and everywhere, and don't look at any of the causes, seems crazy. Let's lean into this idea, like, let's imagine government pushing and doing all the things we want. Let's imagine the structural changes.
Yeah, you know, sounds so that, like Build Back Better, right?
I mean, Build Back Better.
A little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I mean, honestly, when we think about what an infrastructure bill would mean that would be bottom-up, would start with communities most in need of resources, of jobs, of affordable housing, of
education.
Of education.
Of
a clean, green economy.
No, but all those things, those lead to public safety.
Correct.
That's how you fight crime.
That's
the way
right.
to fight crime is to invest in housing, to invest in education, to invest in health, to invest in trauma reduction.
Universal health care, right? That is on the ticket of long-term solutions to helping people not need the police, right? So what this means, practically speaking, is these are actually the things that we ought to do in this moment, in Hyde Park, in Inglewood, in other places. When we want to answer the question, what should we do to minimize the chance that people will use guns to settle differences, will act out in public by spraying up whole communities, and will feel the frustrations of their societies by taking them out on their loved ones when they don't have social service or mental health professionals to talk to first. These are the responses. I think we got to lean into that, right? We got to say, here is your answer, right?
And we need a lot more.
And we need a lot more, right?
And yeah, all of those, like you said, are critical and they're incredibly useful.
They're not only useful, they work, right? They stop the harm before it happens at the point of the breakdown, right? When something's broken down.
So if I'm, you know, I'm worried about crime in my neighborhood and I want something immediate and I'm scared right now. And, you know, two jokers on this podcast say, well, you need big structural changes. You know, that sounds almost like pie in the sky stuff. It sounds like it'll never happen. It sounds impossible. And just, you know, hearing you talk and thinking about this made me think about the work that you do as a historian and that these kinds of investments are not only possible, but it's proven that they lead to public safety, that they lead to crime reduction.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, thank you. Thank you for setting me up to talk about the condemnation of blackness. But, you know, the short version of this is at a time in American
short
history.
Short version.
When white people were killing each other on the streets of Chicago, our hometown.
When are we talking about here?
We're talking about the early 20th century, the turn of the 20th century, with huge economic inequalities. White immigrants were struggling. They were subject to all kinds of racist attacks and stigma attached to them. Eventually, this got so bad that prohibition was passed, you know, like ding, 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 massive effort to lock up everybody having anything to do with alcohol distribution.
Like a precursor to war on drugs.
Precursor to war on drugs. Right.
Yeah.
Massive failure. It criminalized the massive numbers of low-income, working-class white people that were committing a lot of crime, to be sure. There was a lot of violence in those communities. But the social response
to it... What was the response?
Response was massive investments in those communities that led from the Progressive Era to the New Deal. They got housing. They got economic security through various rights as workers. We got unemployment insurance. We got Social Security. They got access to the American dream with homes. We got police reform. I mean, we could run down the list of all the things that most people know about as kind of the New Deal, the same stuff that is inspiring Build Back Better today and all kinds of infrastructure. But what people don't realize is a lot of that was absolutely a direct response to crime white working class and immigrant communities.
Yeah. And it
was a massive crime solution response.
A solution.
And it worked. And it worked.
So thank you for that, Professor.
You're welcome.
Let's talk more about today, how we get structural change. Like how can we possibly get this structural change that's going to lead to reduction in crime? And one of the ways we do it is through protest.
Right. That's right. It is a key. I mean, man, you are on fire today. That's right.
I know. Hot.
Yeah, of course. Right. No massive change in society happens without people in the streets demanding change.
A demand.
Demanding change. Needs to be made. people organize people to agree upon what it is that they want to see change. When have we seen this before?
Yeah. I mean, this gets us back to the summer of 2020 and all the protests. And, you know, after George Floyd is killed by police, Breonna Taylor is killed by police, Jacob Blake is killed by police.
Yeah, like massive organizing to change society for the better. And then we get like crazy police crackdown and we get white self-deputized men like Kyle Rittenhouse. I mean, like literally as the response to the possibility of actually changing these things in a big structural way.
Yeah. And, you know, we were recording earlier, and while we were recording, we got news of the verdict in his case, in Kyle Rittenhouse's case, that he was acquitted of all charges.
Yeah, no, and it was disturbing because we were in the middle of talking about all of these issues.
And we were just sort of completely dumbfounded by it and sort of overwhelmed.
Yeah, I mean, it is still hard to fathom that when Kyle Rittenhouse can be acquitted for arming himself to be willing to shoot protesters who are protesting for racial justice and an end to police brutality, that he doesn't symbolize a society writ large that privileges police power over protest. And so to me, part of the challenge for us at this moment in taking stock of our own community, taking stock of where we are, is that a lot of good things are happening in spite of all of this.
Yeah, it also prioritizes policing over healthcare and education and housing and all sorts of things that also, as we know, reduce crime.
Yeah, or even back to like public health interventions, like all these other menu of choices keep falling prey to the immediate need to say we need policing. And yet in so many ways, as we've just talked about, it's not going to get us there. And in fact, it's a source of the problem.
Yeah, it's easy to feel a lot of despair. I mean, sort of in the, you know, hearing the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict, overwhelmed by crime. I've got neighbors who are talking about leaving Chicago.
Yeah. You sent me that Chicago Tribune report about like hundreds of thousands, 200-something thousand black people left
250,000 in the last 20 years, 260,000.
Yeah, plus one, including my mom.
260,000 right? And one. You know, it sucks. Right. Yeah.
You're shorty rough.
You know, and it's hard to think about these big structural changes, you know? It's hard to you know, when the crisis feels right now. But I gotta say that there is a sign of progress from those protests from 2020. It doesn't happen all at once. It happens over time.
Right, yeah. And maybe you and I have to be more patient with people find their
patience.
Way through.
I mean, like, we have to keep on making
these
points.
Well, no, but I mean,
points.
I mean, like,
yeah.
But making the case requires some degree of patience for people who have this existential sense of crisis. Like, I can't send my kid to school right now. Like Lysia's friends, like, you know, you have to come home immediately. Yeah. Like, there is that immediacy. And I think what we want to say in response, what we've said just now, is that you can do both. I mean, and that's like, you need to focus on the things we can do, which are these public health violence interruption responses, redirecting actual public resources towards the actual service providers, social workers who can take care of most of what people need, and make long-term investments in actually changing the conditions that produce and breed violence in the first place.
Yeah, and there, you know, what you're saying is, I think that, listen, we can't wait for some pie-in-the-sky utopia. We can't wait for, like, everything to be solved in order to, like, delve into this important structural work, these big changes. That has to happen right now. Like, we're not going to get to some magical time when there's no violent crime.
Yeah, well, I would say it actually even differently. I would say, one, it's not utopic to see what most communities look like where murders happen, you know, every decade or so, or once a year, right? That's not an abstraction. That's very real in tons of communities across this country.
Yeah.
It describes mostly the community I live in. But everything else that also describes this community is a community with tremendous economic resources, tremendous economic security, a community where people have most of what
they're talking
need.
About your suburb and, in New Jersey.
Yeah, I'm talking about my suburb, but it's just one of many, and they're not all suburbs. Sometimes they're even neighborhoods inside of cities like your yeah. own, like parts
of Hyde Park,
parts of yep. Chicago. Yeah. So I think we have, you know, we have to work to demystify this notion that there is a way to invest in people and not policing. That we want to invest in the actual people because we know we have all the evidence we need to know that we're not doing a very good job yeah. of that.
And we need to do it now. We need to do it now. We need to start.
That's right. And as long as we think that this moment is unique, like no, Khalil and Ben, this is such a crazy moment of bullets flying yeah. everywhere that we
there's,
just need to solve for this
gonna
problem.
Be, there's always going to be the violence. There's always going to be the crime right. that rattles people.
That's yeah. right. You know, there's always going to be the worst case scenario that says, unfortunately, you know, we just have to do these things and police are going to be the people who protect us.
All right, my man.
All right. Love you, man.
I love you, too.
Some of My Best Friends Are is a production of Pushkin Industries. The show is written and hosted by me, Khalil Gibran Muhammad, and my best friend, Ben Austin.
It's produced by Cher Vincent and edited by Karen Shakurji. Our engineer is Martin Gonzalez. Our associate editor is Keishel Williams. Our associate producer is Lucy Sullivan. And our showrunner is Sasha Mathias.
Our executive producers are Lital Molad and Mia LaBelle.
Special thanks to Sophia King, my alderman, to Derica Purnell, the author of Becoming Abolitionist, Police, Protest, and the Pursuit of Freedom, and to my state senator, Robert Peters, who also spoke to us for this episode.
At Pushkin, thanks to Heather Fain, Carly Migliori, John Schnars, and Jacob Weisberg.
Our theme song, Little Lily, is by fellow Chicagoan Avery R. Young from his amazing album, Tubman. You will definitely want to check out more of his music at his website, averyryoung.com.
You can find Pushkin on all social platforms at Pushkin Pods, and you can sign up for our newsletter at pushkin.fm. To find more Pushkin podcasts, listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to listen.
If you love Some of My Best Friends Are and any of the other shows from Pushkin Industries, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus.
Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted listening for $4.99 a month.
Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. If you like this show, please give it a 5-star review. And please tell some of your best friends about it. Like a lot of your best friends.
All of your best friends.
All of your best friends.
Now. Yeah, I mean, as far as a lot of research goes, and this is my Bailiwick.
Right? Bailiwick.
Stuff that Bailiwick. I learned out of policy school. That's right, Bailiwick, new word of the day.
Man, that's how people talk at Harvard.
Is that...
Excuse me, sir. This is my Bailiwick today. You know, no, that's my Bailiwick.
So, all right, we got it.